Preface. It is in the nature of a polemical book to seem like an attack on the view to which it is a rejoinder. In writing this book, I have not seen myself as being on the offensive against a settled alternative Christian viewpoint, but as one merely endeavoring to hold the fort against an aggressive and virulent new doctrine which deliberately challenges the historic Christian faith. I hope that nothing I have written may give the impression of an attack on other Christians. Those whom I am writing to correct initiated the attack against historic Christian truths and seek to unseat the views of all Christians who have lived in the first 19 centuries. Such innovators cannot be surprised to receive resistance from defenders of historic evangelical faith. Throughout the last 2,000 years, the Church has divided over many issues. It seems that at any given time, there were sincere Christians somewhere denying some doctrine that other believers held to be sacrosanct. One thing that no theological camp ever denied, however, was that the Bible teaches a second coming of Christ at the end of this present age. The future second advent of Christ has been held by Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Coptic, and Protestant churches of every denomination. Until very recently, this hope of the saints has not been a disputed doctrine in any Christian communion. In the 1970s, Max King, a minister in the Churches of Christ, began to promote a radical theological system which he called transmillennialism, also called covenant eschatology. Today, it is better known by the labels full preterism or hyperpreterism. Building on the ideas of 19th century thinkers like James Stuart Russell and Milton Terry, who had interpreted most of the eschatological passages in Scripture as referring to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, King went so far as to say that every prophecy in the Bible was fulfilled no later than that event. Thus, every scriptural mention of the second coming of Christ, of the resurrection, the rapture, the final judgment, the new heavens and the new earth, he claimed, were fulfilled at that time, and nothing remains to be fulfilled in the future. The destruction of Jerusalem was the very second coming of Christ, ushering in the final eternal age, which now prevails and will have no end. The only future hope of the believer is to die and go to heaven, while the earth and countless future generations continue on forever. King's views were as radically at odds with all historic Christianity as were those of Joseph Smith and John Nelson Darby, who founded Mormonism and dispensationalism, respectively. Like Smith and Darby, it was necessary for King to claim that no church father or subsequent Christian theologian had ever correctly grasped the biblical witness concerning doctrines of the first order of importance. Never had there been a major teacher or movement that did not anticipate a future resurrection and judgment at the return of Christ. While being almost as novel as King's views, both Mormonism and dispensationalism were closer to historic Christianity in terms of eschatology. The creation of novel religious ideas is a popular enterprise for people of a certain iconoclastic stripe. The Church has historically made so many embarrassing mistakes that it is tempting to speculate as to how many major doctrines it may have botched. While Church history has witnessed the rise of many heresies, it would be hard to identify a doctrine upon which all Christians were making the same major mistake together, unless Max King and his followers are correct. Some of us may be very open to allowing the Scriptures to challenge certain widely held Christian viewpoints. However, whenever someone wants to say that literally all Christians have been wrong for 2,000 years concerning one of their major doctrines, the burden of proof would seem to lie heavily upon the challenger. We must remember that the resurrection of the dead and eternal judgment are listed in Scripture as being among the foundational doctrines of Christ, Hebrews 6 verses 1 through 3. They were identified as the blessed hope of all believers, Titus 2:13, and the rationale for enduring every hardship, even unto death, 1 Corinthians 15, verses 30 through 32. The second coming of Christ is said to be the terminus antequem of both the presence of Christ with us in fulfilling the Great Commission, Matthew 28, verses 19 through 20, and of the church's proclamation of the Lord's death in the communion meal, 1 Corinthians 11, verse 26. The futurity of this event was not only affirmed by certain Christian teachers and movements, but by every one of them, until very recently. If Smith, Darby, and King wish to persuade us that all Christians before them, even those closest to the apostles, who spoke and read biblical Greek as their native language, consistently read the scriptures incorrectly, then let us hear their case. However, when we say that the burden of proof is theirs to bear, we mean that they had better bring forward flawless exegesis, which cannot be reasonably assailed on every determinative text of Scripture. It is not enough to show that certain passages that have improperly been applied to the future are actually referencing events long past. Such a claim needn't be regarded as too controversial. What they must demonstrate is that there is not one verse of Scripture predicting any event that has not yet been fulfilled. If this cannot be done, then their claims to superior insight are revealed to be exactly what we suspected when we first encountered them, extremely immodest and unsubstantiated. What can one be called other than arrogant who claims to know what no previous saint or scholar of Scripture has ever known or seen? I have frequently been asked why I, who have been a partial preterist for some 40 years, have never gone all the way into full preterism. The inquirers, being of the latter persuasion, often refer to their own view as consistent preterism. The alleged consistency they claim for themselves is found in their accepting the hermeneutical principles which partial preterists apply to some passages, and applying the same approach to all eschatological passages. They ask, if one takes portions of the Book of Revelation, the Olivet Discourse, and many Old Testament books as having been fulfilled ages ago, why would one not take the quote-unquote consistent approach of assigning a past fulfillment to all biblical prophecies? It seemingly would be equally fitting to ask why anyone who takes the resurrection of Christ as a literal and physical phenomenon would not exhibit the consistency of seeing the quote-unquote resurrection of those who were declared to be dead in trespasses and sins to likewise refer to a physical resurrection. If quote-unquote resurrection is physical when applied to Christ, why is it not physical when applied to the Christian's regeneration? The answer surely is that we all recognize in Scripture certain themes, terms, and motifs that bear more than one meaning when appearing in different contexts and usages. When Jesus passed from death unto life, it was in physical resurrection, as shall also be the case for us on the last day. However, when believers are said to have already passed from death into life, this is speaking of something else. Even full preterists recognize this. There is a quote-unquote consistency that is unwarranted when such disparate subjects are under consideration. Even the dispensationalists who boast of, quote, consistently taking prophecy literally, end quote, seem to be wise enough to depart from their stated consistently literal policy when speaking, for example, of the lamb having seven horns and seven eyes, or of a beast having seven heads and ten horns. They know that these descriptions are symbolic, though they may not acknowledge to themselves that they are not in such cases adhering to their professed literal hermeneutic. Nobody is foolish enough to follow such a literalistic hermeneutic, quote-unquote, consistently. All Christians show such discretion with reference to messianic prophecies in the Old Testament. Some we take literally. For example, that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem, of a virgin, and would ride a donkey into Jerusalem, while others we recognize as figurative. For example, that the Messiah would be a branch, a rod, a stone, a sunrise, or a shepherd tending sheep. If dispensationalists, whom full preterists often deride as naive, are nonetheless able to recognize that the same hermeneutic cannot be consistently applied to every case, I would hope that our often self-congratulatory full preterists could exercise at least as much discretion. My reason for not going the way of full preterism is my inclination to approach the scriptures with such discretion. The proverbial slippery slope. Criticism of partial preterism, whether coming from the futurist or the full preterist camp, often argues that the acknowledging of certain disputed prophecies as having been fulfilled in the past must inevitably place one on a slippery slope leading straight into the clutches of full preterism. My first reaction to those who say this is, why in the world should this be the case? It seems to me that a rational interpreter will seek to assign the proper interpretation to each passage on a case-by-case basis, and not to use such an irresponsibly broad exegetical brush. All historic Christian expositors have recognized that some of the messianic prophecies have been fulfilled in the past, while recognizing that some prophecies await a future fulfillment. Virtually every Christian in history, until the 1970s, as we shall see, could technically be called both a partial preterist and a partial futurist. That some prophecies had a past fulfillment has been uncontroversial. Differences of opinion had only to do with how many prophecies and which ones. However, the actual label partial preterist has come to be reserved for those who find, especially in the Olivet Discourse and the Book of Revelation, a high degree of fulfillment in the past, particularly in the fall of Jerusalem. This is the perspective from which this writer is coming. My interest in writing on this subject is not to promote my particular eschatological outlook. To me, eschatology is less interesting than matters of Christian discipleship, matters upon which one's eschatology may have minimal impact. My own view for the past 40 years has been that of a partial preterist. As a teacher, I have often been asked the difference between partial and full preterism, and why one who has accepted the former would not embrace the latter. A partial preterist has come to recognize that certain expressions in Scripture that sound like descriptions of the end of the universe are actually apocalyptic representations of earthly disasters, like the fall of Jerusalem to the Romans in AD 70. This awareness is capable of being irresponsibly extended to include every passage using similar terminology, as if all refer to this one event. They ask why such a consistent approach should not be followed. These students of Scripture do not find it hard to recognize that various prophecies concerning the doom of Egypt, Babylon, or Edom, etc., while using similar or identical language, were fulfilled at different times in history. Yet they seem to have difficulty with the concept that Jesus' predictions concerning the end of the Second Temple could be fulfilled at one time, while his predictions concerning the resurrection and judgment of all people and all nations would be fulfilled at another time. A question of motives. I am often asked why a partial preterist like myself would not slide all the way down the slope to full preterism. One speculation suggested by those in the full preterist camp is that partial preterists, like myself, simply do not have the courage to support such a minority position. This is a strange charge, since partial preterism is itself a minority position and is greatly reviled in some, especially dispensationalist, circles. There are a number of full preterists who have spread a rumor about me personally, saying that I have as much as admitted to having such a low motive for rejecting full preterism. I have never made any statement to that effect, and it is certainly not the case, as will be seen in the following chapters. The accusers refer to a comment of mine made in a debate between myself and the full preterist, quote-unquote debatesman, as he is sometimes called, Don K. Preston, in Denver in 2013. At one point, I was acknowledging my sympathies for how difficult it must be to be a full preterist, in view of its radical divergence from the views of all historical Christianity. My actual comment was, quote, "I was seriously contemplating the other day, If I were ever to become a full preterist, how would that impact my ministry? It would end it, which, I'll be frank with you, makes me very careful about being persuaded too easily. End quote. Footnote. Debate on Full Preterism. Don K. Preston, Full Preterist, versus Steve Gregg, Partial Preterist, September 6th through 8th, 2013, in Denver, Colorado. DVDs and MP3s are available from Don Preston for a price. He has graciously allowed us to post the audio files for free listening at our website. My comment was made in the first 30 seconds of this segment, found at thenarrowpath.com/audio/topical-lectures/various-debates/17-full-preterism-part-4-Steve-Gregg-. End footnote. A few critics have seized upon this mere statement of fact and implied that it reveals something about my secret motives for rejecting the full preterist position. They represent me as having said that I would embrace that view if only it would not adversely affect my career. Obviously, my statement neither stated nor implied anything about my reasons for believing or disbelieving anything. It would indeed compromise my ministry if I were to take the full preterist position, for the simple reason that doing so would seriously undermine my credibility as a responsible Bible teacher, in my own eyes as well as others. The same would be true if I were to become a believer in the flat earth position. Such a shift would ruin my credibility, and it should. But this is not my reason for rejecting either position. Flat earthism and belief in full preterism are both views that I, and almost all careful students of Scripture, reject upon exegetical and other evidential grounds. If I were inclined to restrict all of my theological convictions to the realm of safe, popular theology, I would never have allowed my studies to lead me to embrace amillennialism or partial preterism while ministering in a staunchly dispensationalist environment, possibly the least welcoming of all environments for the acceptance of such views. I have no difficulty declaring my motives for rejecting full preterism, or flat earthism for that matter. It is because, as a student of Scripture, I find the exegesis supporting such teachings to be very weak at crucial points. I hold no malice toward the full preterists that I have known, but confess that I find the exegetical support they provide for their principal claims deficient and excessively agenda-driven. The task undertaken in the present work is not to prove that every point of full preterism is weak or incorrect, since some of its arguments are quite strong, and I believe correct, but to show that it is incorrect in its unique claims and essential arguments. I am not the first to write such a correction to this movement, and do not desire to reinvent the wheel. However, I am regularly asked my thoughts about it, and wish to answer in my own words. I am not writing so much to attack as to defend the long-settled Christian understanding of the coming of Christ. The full preterists who have engaged me have imagined that no adequate response can be made to meet their challenges. They are mistaken. It is not in my power to dissuade anyone from believing what they insist upon believing. If I were to set such a goal for myself, I should be greatly disappointed. I am writing simply to demonstrate that the Scriptures more than adequately justify the historical position of the Church and do not comport with the full preterist claims. If I should in the process persuade any full preterist, or one considering full preterism as an option, that my position is not only defensible but also correct, that would please me well. I am not a controversialist by temperament, but when it comes to engaging with error, I am more than willing to join the discussion. I have found most of my dialogues with full preterists to be somewhat frustrating, though they have been mostly cordial. How can a cordial dialogue be found frustrating? It is simply that the awareness eventually dawns upon one, in the midst of such conversations, that there are too many points of disagreement to adequately vet them all in any one discussion. For that reason, and mainly to limit the need for such fruitless discussions, I have for some time promised my students and correspondents that I would lay out my case fully in a book. This is the fulfillment of that promise.